Welcome to episode 9 in the 5th season of Justice with John Carpe, a podcast from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms. I'm the show's producer, Kevin Steele, and with me is our host, John Carpe, who is the president and founder of the center. Now, when I scanned my eyes down the list of topics John and I came up with for this week's show, that is the final list, it is instantly obvious that they all have one thing in common. They all have something to do with the highest court in the land, the Supreme Court of Canada. I can't say we originally planned it this way, but golly gee, some weeks, I tells you, it just all comes together. Now I gotta come up with a title, and it no doubt will be some kind of cheesy pun on the word supreme. But that's actually a task for later. For the moment, John, open-ended question, in no particular order, what's up with the Supreme Court of Canada?
Well, Justice Sheila Martin apparently believes that a woman should not be called a woman, but should be called a person with a vagina. This has made international headlines and has embarrassed the court. And it's pretty much the entire court. Everybody except for Justice Roe signed on to this ruling. So it's not just some crazy nut bar dissent, but the whole court signed on to this ruling. This is from a case called R versus Kruk, K-R-U-K. You can look up the Supreme Court's ruling as well as trial judgment on Canlii, C-A-N-L-I-I .ca, which is Canadian Legal Information Institute, but the website is Canlii, C-A-N-L-I-I. It's got all the court decisions there, fairly easy to use. So this is a 2017 sexual assault charge against a man from Maple Ridge, British Columbia, 34 years old at the time. And it was a very sad story, which is pretty typical for most criminal law cases. They involve sad stories, whether the accused is found guilty or acquitted. They're always sad stories. This was a woman who was very, very, very intoxicated. She was lost. She was distressed. And Charles Kruk picked her up and took her to his house, and then later on there's this allegation that he sexually assaulted her. And I'm actually surprised that he was convicted, because the judge says that the complainant was extremely inebriated, extremely intoxicated, to the point of having very poor memory. And the judge goes through all these contradictions and statements that are not true, et cetera, et cetera. So the complainant has very low credibility, yet at the end of the day, the judge believes the complainant on this assertion. So I will read one paragraph from the trial decision, and it probably should not be children listening for the next few sentences. Quote, having rejected important parts of the accused's evidence, I must assess the entire body of evidence to determine if I'm satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the offense occurred. In particular, I must assess the core assertion made by the complainant that, when she woke up, the accused's penis was inside her vagina. Her evidence is devoid of detail, yet she claims to be certain that she was not mistaken. She said she felt his penis inside her and she knew what she was feeling. In short, her tactile sense was engaged. It is extremely unlikely that a woman would be mistaken about that feeling, end of quote. So, this went up to the BC Court of Appeal, which overturned the conviction and ordered a new trial. So it didn't say that it was a wrong decision necessarily, but had problems with it. This then went to the Supreme Court of Canada, which restored the trial decision that the guy was convicted and found guilty. So here we have Justice Sheila Martin, somebody who used to be the Dean of Law at University of Calgary Law School when I was my first-year student there. Sheila Martin was the Dean of Law. Okay, quote, where a person with a vagina testifies credibly and with certainty that they felt penile vaginal penetration, a trial judge must be entitled to conclude that they are unlikely to be mistaken. While the choice of the trial judge to use the words, quote, a woman, quote, may have been unfortunate and engendered confusion, in context, it is clear the judge was reasoning that it was extremely unlikely that the complainant would be mistaken about the feeling of penile vaginal penetration because people generally, even if intoxicated, are not mistaken about that sensation. In other words, the judge's conclusion was grounded in his assessment of the complainant's testimony. The Court of Appeal, the BC Court of Appeal, erred in finding otherwise. End of quote. So, I mean, this is just so stupid. I don't know where to begin. To use the words, a woman may have been unfortunate. Yeah, that's really sad to refer to a woman as a woman. And engendered confusion. Well, yes, we all know how confused we get when people talk about a woman or women. You know, everybody's just like, I don't know what you're talking about.
You've come a long way, baby.
But so the even more ridiculous is that this case has nothing to do with transgenderism, transgender ideology, transgender rights. You know, the court's not making some sort of a human rights ruling about, you know, whether a guy who feels like he's a woman is entitled to be treated like a woman and whether, you know, the employer has got to allow the dude to go into the women's washroom. Like, none of this stuff. This is a case of a woman who says that she was sexually assaulted and the accused is a male, probably heterosexual. And this is not like a transgender case where you might expect to see this kind of stuff. But yet, just to recap that first sentence, quote, where a person with a vagina testifies credibly and with certainty that they felt blah, blah, blah. And now where it gets even more scary, arguably, and Jamie Sarkonak has an excellent column in the National Post. It's about the politicization of the judiciary and how the rule of law is breaking down and Canadians cannot trust courts when courts take positions on political issues that are the topic of political debate. So, for example, right now in Canada in the last 5 years, 10 years, and probably the next 5, 10 years or longer, there's a big debate about is gender based on biology or is gender based on identification? I know which side of the argument I'm on, but, you know, there are people in Canada that are arguing that, no, you know, gender's got nothing to do with your body, but it's all about how you feel. You have a debate. I mean, it's a stupid debate. It shouldn't exist because I'm biased. Okay. There's only two genders. That's my opinion. There are people who feel unhappy about the body that they're in, and there are people that struggle with gender identity and so on. But, and notwithstanding that, there's only two genders. Okay, there's other people argue that it's this whole spectrum. So it's a political debate. Courts should not wade in on that political debate. It's like any other issue, right? We have a permanent debate about taxation levels. Many of us, I would be on this side, think that, you know, taxes are too high, governments are too big. But there's other people that think that government should be a lot bigger than what they are now and should be spending a lot more money than what they are now, or should be spending the same amount of money, but on very different things. It's a political debate. It would not be appropriate for a Canadian court at any level to weigh in with, you know, oh, well, current taxation levels are good. They're right. Or they're too high or they're too low. No, you don't weigh in on that. Current immigration levels, no court should pronounce itself on whether we need more immigration, less immigration, or same numbers but different composition. It's a political question. But here you've got this court jumping in where Justice Sheila Martin, joined by almost the entirety of the rest of the court, they're all signing on to this judgment where it's not a woman, it's a person with a vagina. That is the court signaling its politics. So how can you have confidence if, for example, what's likely to happen in Alberta, Danielle Smith, the premier, announced in January a bunch of policies pertaining to transgender issues for youth and whether, you know, and youth can't get surgery before the age of 18 and no puberty blockers without parental consent at certain ages and no puberty blockers at all at other ages, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, this is going to be challenged sooner or later by somebody saying that it's violation of charter rights and freedoms. So if Alberta's policies make their way to the Supreme Court, how can we get an unbiased hearing when the Supreme Court has already said, quote, that a woman is not a woman, but is a person with a vagina? How are we supposed to trust the court to issue a fair ruling when they've already declared pretty much which way they're going to rule, or they've hinted their direction?
Yeah, they've taken a side. And I just want to point out, actually, this is something that Jamie Sarkonic mentions in her column. To gender ideologues, I'm quoting here, this is inclusionary language. That's what they call it. And the same goes for chest feeding parents or menstruators, et cetera. This is all according to Jamie, or I guess gender ideologues, inclusionary language. That's what the side that they're taking on. The Supreme Court has decided to use this inclusionary language. And by using it, you indicate that they seem to have taken a side in this issue.
Well, and to quote from that same column, this is very eloquent. In one sentence, quoting from Jamie, quote, in Canada, the status quo isn't great because the half of us who don't buy into the concept of a gender spectrum, completely debased from binary biological sex, cannot expect to be heard fairly should we ever end up in court over the matter, end of quote. And that sums it up on that. Related to that, in regards to International Women's Day, which was the 8th of March, the Supreme Court itself, Supreme Court tweet, now X, quote, Canadians need to see themselves reflected in their judiciary because that builds trust in our democratic institutions, end of quote. Okay, well, this is problematic for so many reasons on so many levels. First of all, the court is not a democratic institution because judges are not voted onto the court, although I guess you could say it's a democratic institution in the broad sense that it's part of our democracy. So we've got Parliament consisting of the House of Commons and the Senate, and we've got the courts, and it's all part of the democracy. So I guess in that indirect sense, you could say that the court is a democratic institution. But strictly speaking, it's not kind of what you'd think, right? Canadians need to see themselves reflected in their judiciary. So that's a pronouncement in favor of affirmative action policies. This is like immigration and taxation and transgender ideology. This is a topic of debate. There are some Canadians believe very strongly that the workforce and the House of Commons and the Supreme Court should all be a microcosm of all of society. So, you know, if there's a large company with 10,000 employees, then if, 1% of Canadians are same-sex attracted, then the company's employees, 1% of the employees have to be same-sex attracted. And if 3% of Canada's population is Vietnamese, then 3% of the company's workforce needs to be Vietnamese. And if 51% of Canadians are women, I won't even mention the alternative of what Sheila Martin would call those people, if 51% of the population are female, then 51% of the company's workforce should be female, et cetera, et cetera. Now, some people believe in affirmative action and, you know, that the House of Commons should be, you know, 50% female and the Supreme Court should be 50% female, although it's actually 55% female currently because women are the majority. But, and then other people who are classical liberals like myself would say, no, we disagree with quotas. Let the chips fall where they may. Just because a particular workforce is not a perfect microcosm of society does not necessarily mean it's caused by racism and sexism and homophobia. There could be all kinds of different reasons why a workforce is not a perfect microcosm of society. In any event, it's not up to the government to impose quotas on any workforce, any industry, any employer, or the House of Commons, or the Supreme Court, or the Federal Civil Service, etc. Political issue.
Yeah. I just want to point out that to our audience that John keeps using this old-timey term, affirmative action, and I think he means diversity, equity, and inclusion is what they call it today. So just to update you.
I call it quotas, mandatory quotas imposed by government. Yes, equity, diversity, inclusion. Sure.
Yeah.
So here the Supreme Court saying Canadians need to see themselves reflected in their judiciary. So that's suggesting that the Supreme Court believes that if you were to put all of Canada's judges into a room, however, hundreds or thousands, I don't know what the grand total is, but hundreds for sure, possibly thousands, that in this big room of all the judges, you're going to see society reflected. Well, again, that's a political stance, and some Canadians would agree, some would disagree. Then they go on to say that that builds trust. Okay, that's another political assertion. It's kind of the same divide. To me, it's the opposite. If there's affirmative action policies, I involuntarily question whether somebody got the job because of their talent and competence and merit, and they were the best qualified, or I get these questions in my mind. Well, is that person there because of their race or their gender or some other personal characteristics because of a quota system? So I think quotas lead to less trust. Conversely, if you have no quotas, well, then there's just no question that, okay, so that person's there because they're the best qualified. Anyway, you know, agree or disagree. What my point is that the court should not be making a pronouncement on this, which is exactly what they've done when they say, quote, Canadians need to see themselves reflected in their judiciary because that builds trust in our democratic institutions, end of quote. Next quote, from the Supreme Court of Canada, quote, achieving gender parity, I think that's a polite term for quotas. achieving gender parity. And by the way, it's a bit ambiguous. Does that mean equal numbers of male and female, or are we denying that male and female exist so there's a spectrum, and so we need to see kind of a spectrum on the court? Anyway, sorry, I keep on interrupting the Supreme Court. Let the Supreme Court speak. Quote, achieving gender parity among judges at all levels in Canada is a step in the right direction towards having greater diversity on the bench. End of quote. Well, achieving gender parity would mean that one of the five women on the Supreme Court should resign. Oh, no, that would be five men, four women. Okay, well, I don't know. Maybe we need a non-binary ninth person in there and have, you know, four males, four females, and then a judge who is neither. I don't know how they want to achieve their gender parity.
Can I just interrupt for a second? And just for our audience, I just want to point out that John keeps using this old timey term women when he really means person with a vagina.
Yeah. Those are your words, Kevin. You must be a fan of Sheila Martin. I guess she wants us all to change our speech.
That was just, you set it up. That's all. Okay. Yeah. No worries. Please continue.
A step in the right direction towards having greater diversity on the bench. Ah, there's a buzzword, diversity. So do they mean also diversity of opinion? Are we going to have a quota, affirmative action quotas for conservative-minded people where, you know, one quarter or one third or one fifth or, you know, of the judicial appointments are conservative-minded people who believe in limited government and traditional values and the rule of law and are not woke activists? Is that what they mean by greater diversity on the bench? I doubt it. So another tweet from the Supreme Court of Canada. This one comes with a photo of the five female justices, Moreau, Aubonsowin, Karakatsanis, Côté, and Martin. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Quote, we celebrate International Day of Women Judges. Oh, I guess that's separate from the rest of the women. That doesn't sound very equity and equality. Female judges have a separate day from non-judges. Anyway, I don't know. We celebrate International Day of Women Judges, which recognizes the importance of the full and equal participation of women at all levels of the judiciary. Again, I think we should just appoint the best qualified. And the Alberta Court of Appeal for a long time had a female majority. I think that was just the way the chips fell. I don't know if it does currently. I don't care about the gender of the judge, but let's just appoint the best qualified people. And Supreme Court of Canada, please stop sending out these political tweets, because every time you do, you undermine confidence in the judiciary. Thank you.
I would just like to point out that those three tweets that John just read there were all sent out in the same minute. That's okay. 7 a.m. So they went bang, bang, bang. They obviously had that planned.
Same thing goes, and this is an excellent column by Dr. Barry Bussey in the Epoch Times titled Politicization of Supreme Court of Canada Started Long Before, quote, woman, quote, dust up. So Barry references Jamie Sarkonak's excellent column, which Kevin, I'm sure you'll link to as well. Quote, we didn't need person with a vagina added to the legal vernacular. And then Barry Bussey, he reminds us that Chief Justice Wagner stated in regards to the peaceful protest in Ottawa 2 years and a month ago, the Freedom Convoy, Wagner stated the Freedom Convoy, quote, should be denounced with force by all figures of power in the country, end of quote. Let that sink in for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
You get the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. When we've got litigation coming up, I mean, we had the Justice Center was the first civil liberties group in Canada to have lawyers filing a court action seeking a declaration that the Prime Minister was wrong. It was acting illegally when invoking the Emergencies Act. So we acted, we represented or provided lawyers for these four Canadians who and have laid the evidentiary basis, who had been impacted themselves with the freezing of bank accounts. And later there was other civil liberties organizations that filed their applications as well, which is great. That was extremely helpful. We laid the groundwork with our court action that set out the facts. And then we got a ruling January 23rd that the Prime Minister acted illegally when declaring a national emergency, and he violated charter rights and freedoms with his emergency decree, in particular, the freezing of bank accounts. So the federal government's going to appeal that to the Federal Court of Appeal, which is going to either uphold the lower court ruling or overturn it. Then whoever loses at the Federal Court of Appeal level is going to ask the Supreme Court of Canada for leave. So this might come before Chief Justice Wagner, who has publicly declared that the Freedom Convoy should be denounced with force by all figures of power in the country. Totally inappropriate, totally out of line. He dismissed the complaint against himself that was filed with the Judicial Council.
Yeah, there was a complaint filed against him for that comment. And of course, yeah, it got dismissed. I found this column interesting because he did some good research and reminded us of some important precedents that have come before. Did you find that impressive as well? And maybe you want to go through that. This was going back to the 80s. Glaskin on the Supreme Court was chastising a BC judge, Thomas Berger, I believe it was, for weighing in on a political issue. And it came up then, and there were several pronouncements made at that time.
Yeah, Justice Berger publicly criticized the way Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau had handled the Indigenous rights file during the charter negotiations. And for that, he was chided by Supreme Court of Canada Chief Justice Bora Laskin. And when a complaint was filed against British Columbia Justice Thomas Berger, complaint was filed with the Canadian Justice Council. And they said that he had stepped over the line, would normally be removed from office, but quote, such a severe sanction should not be invoked in this instance, quote, would be unfair, they said, to remove a judge on the basis of standards of judicial restraint, which had not previously been enunciated, end of quote. So pretty strong denunciation and saying, well, you're the first one to make this big mistake, so, you know, we'll denounce it, but he didn't have to resign. But then it sure shifted from the 1980s. Then 40 years later, in 2022, a group of 13 lawyers, I know some of them, sent a complaint to the Canadian Judicial Council against Chief Justice Wagner for his public comments against Freedom Convoy. And the Canadian Judicial Council threw out the lawyers' complaint with the following statement, quote, considering that your complaint is unsupported, is largely based on a hypothetical scenario, is manifestly without substance, and does not concern judicial conduct, it does not warrant further consideration by the council, end of quote. Wow. Well, no, it is supported. When Justice Wagner publicly makes it known that he thinks that the truckers are a bunch of bad guys and it's chaos and it's anarchy, just expressing negative sentiment, which, by the way, I grant him his personal rights to feel that way, to think that way, to believe that way. And even he even has a right in private conversations with people. He could say whatever he wants. I think those truckers are all, they're all racist or dangerous, violent, criminal, whatever. You know, he's entitled to his opinions, and in private conversations, he can express them. But this is a public attack on the truckers. So to say that the complaint is unsupported is really stupid. This is like the old saying, the big lie works better than the small lie. So they're coming out both guns blazing. This complaint is unsupported. It's based on a hypothetical scenario. No, it isn't. There's court cases that are going to make their way up to the Supreme Court of Canada pertaining to Freedom Convoy. So it's not hypothetical at all. Manifestly without substance. Oh wait, manifestly. Yeah. And does not concern judicial conduct. Well, in fact, yes, it is judicial conduct when a judge publicly makes comments. Your words are part of your behavior. So it's very much judicial conduct.
Yeah, and to go by the Laskin-Berger precedent, at this point, the judge should be booted. I mean, you know, they said, well, you know, we won't boot Berger because this was the first time it's happened and we haven't laid down the law. But then they laid down the law and said, this is what the infraction is. So that infraction is now on the record. It has been adjudicated. And at that point, maybe that's why they came out so forceful against it, because they realized that, you know, he should be gone. The only way they can save him is the big lie.
Yeah. It reminds me of the judge who rendered moot Brian Peckford's challenge to the travel mandates. And the evidence was so strongly against the federal government. Government officials admitted under oath that there was no medical or scientific basis for barring non-injected Canadians from traveling on airplanes. And she would have had to, if she has any integrity and looking at the evidence just wasn't there to support the ban. So she would have had to rule against the federal government based on the evidence. So therefore, she said the action is moot, even though the federal government had said, you know, we're merely suspending this. We could bring it back at any time. Pretty obvious why it's not moot when the government could bring it back on a moment's notice. And the parties had already invested so much time and effort and energy and money into that court action. It was a huge multiple days of hearing, numerous expert reports, witnesses. So yeah, similar situation there. You declare it moot, and then you're not in this awkward situation of having to rule against the federal government.
Yeah, and in this column, he also takes a moment to remind us of who, as he says, articulated the famous legal maxim. Quote, "It is of fundamental importance that justice should not only be done, but should manifestly and undoubtedly be seen to be done," unquote. That's Lord Chief Justice of England, Gordon Hewart. So, that's the thing. If a judge says it in public, it's what is seen, then everybody gets to see it. And if they see that he is biased, then justice is not seen to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got our work cut out. I've said previously on many times that we've got a problem of a cultural rot, and that cultural rot has got tentacles everywhere, and it reaches into our education system and, you know, persuading little boys that they're not boys and that they're girls and they should, you know, work on a transition. Just the dumbing down of public education, the removal of history as a core subject that is taught throughout 12 grades. And it, you know, goes into the popular culture, the media, the entertainment, the judiciary, politics. I don't know if I mentioned media, but definitely the corruption there, where a lot of self-described journalists simply lack integrity. They don't love truth. They're not looking for truth. They're propagandists for a big government message. And that's okay from a free speech standpoint. If you're not pretending to be a journalist and truth-seeking and truth-loving and truth-finding and truth-reporting, because that's what a journalist should be, if you admit that you're an advocate for, you know, for big government or for small government or for this or that, if you admit that you're an advocate, well, more power to you. Now you're being honest. But if you pretend to be a journalist and you are not reporting, you're reporting only one perspective, and everything that you're reporting is designed to promote a particular viewpoint on an issue, that's the corruption. So the cultural rot is everywhere, and we just got to fight it whenever we can, wherever we can, including in the courts.
And I just like to point out where they go wrong in the media, they always say that, you know, we're your trusted source. That's where they claim the integrity of bringing you the truth by calling themselves a trusted source. Now, I'd like to maybe flip over right now, and maybe we can take the side of the Chief Justice for a second, since after we just sort of, you know, slammed him pretty hard there. This is a story about the judicial, the shortage of judges, actually. Maybe you'd like to talk about that, John.
Yeah, I'm going to read sections of a letter that I think is very well written by Chief Justice Wagner to the Right Honorable Justin Trudeau, dated May 3rd, 2023. This is a public letter, public document. Dear Prime Minister, as Chief Justice of Canada and Chairperson of the Canadian Judicial Council, I must express my deep concern with regard to the significant number of vacancies within federal judicial affairs and the government's inability to fill these positions in a timely manner. The current situation is untenable, and I fear this will result in a crisis for our justice system, which is already facing many challenges. Access to justice and the health of our democratic institutions are at risk. As you undoubtedly know, there are currently 85 vacancies within federal judicial affairs across the country. Some courts have had to deal with a 10% to 15% vacancy rate for years now. It is also not uncommon for positions to remain vacant for several months, if not years in some cases. As a concrete example, over half of the positions at the Manitoba Court of Appeal are currently vacant. It should be noted that the difficulties brought on by the judge shortage are exacerbating an already critical situation within several courts, namely a serious lack of resources due to chronic underfunding by the provinces and territories. The slow pace of appointments is all the more difficult to understand since most judicial vacancies are predictable, especially those resulting from retirements, for which judges usually provide several months' notice. In this context, these delays in appointments send a message that this is simply not a priority for the government. It is essential that the vacant positions within the judiciary be filled diligently to ensure that judicial branch functions properly. In the past, the Canadian Judicial Council has urged governments to make judicial appointments more quickly. This time, we have serious concerns that without concrete efforts to remedy the situation, we will soon reach a point of no return in several jurisdictions. The consequences will make headlines and have serious repercussions on our democracy and on all Canadians. The situation requires your immediate attention.
This is an excellent letter. And I take it all back, Chief Justice. You know, no, this is good. And I'm glad that
let me continue with another one or two. By the way, I'm reading parts. Sure. I'm reading parts of it, not the whole thing.
Oh, okay. Please continue. Sorry.
Yeah. Despite all our judges' professionalism and dedication, the staffing shortage inevitably results in additional delays in hearing cases and rendering judgments. Chief justices in various provinces have indicated that because judges are overburdened, delays in setting cases are unavoidable and hearings need to be postponed and adjourned. What's more, even when cases are heard, judgments are slow to be rendered because judges need to spend more time sitting, leaving them less time to deliberate. End of quote. I'm going to stop there. I've brought this up many times in the past 4 years of this podcast. It's inexcusable that it takes years to get a ruling when it should take weeks, maybe months. You saw this with the lockdowns. In the United States, you had challenges to public health orders as being unjustified violations of, be it religious freedom or freedom of speech or assembly or whatever. And we had all kinds of rulings in the United States. Many of them, my impression is most, although I've not done a proper, thorough, a formal study, but most of them ruling against the government as, discriminating against religion, targeting religion when they're, you know, leaving all the liquor stores and everything non-religious is untouched, but, oh, we got to close churches, you know. But here's the point. Even if these rulings have been all, you know, pro-government and, yeah, lockdowns are all fantastic, they got these rulings within months. Here in Canada, the Ingram case, the Justice Center was the first civil liberties group to start suing governments over lockdowns. We did that in 2020. In December 2020, we sued the Alberta government, then run by Jason Kenney, who, in case anybody says political activism doesn't work, he's gone now, and that's because of political activism. Jason Kenney was violating our rights and freedoms with the health orders, and so we filed suit in December of 2020, and we got a ruling 2.5 years later, July of 2023. So it took 2.5 years. Now, part of that was the court had a strong pro-government bias, you know, giving them 6 months to come up with evidence when supposedly the government was saying, oh, you know, our violation of charter rights and freedoms is justified. Oh, and it's all based on science. Well, if it's all based on science, why do you need 6 months to produce it? 6 days, okay, maybe 6 weeks, but 6 months, really? Anyway, it took a long time. Part of that is the shortage of judges. And justice delayed is justice denied. And there's a valid point there that, so why does it take a year to get a ruling? Well, because when there's a judge shortage, then the judge, instead of, you know, taking a day or two or three or a week, instead of taking the time to write the judgment, which is a long, long process, you need to really summarize all of the evidence and then explain why one side's evidence is more persuasive than the other side. So it's a difficult job and it is time consuming. But if you've got to be back in court tomorrow morning to listen to, you know, your morning chambers application where applications where people are coming in with all kinds of stuff and you need to hear all these new cases, it's going to take longer for the judgments to get released. Good point on the part of the Chief Justice. So this turned into a court action. So reading briefly from a National Post article, quote, the Prime Minister is appealing a judge's order that the Liberals fill an unacceptably high number of judicial vacancies within a reasonable time, saying it vastly exceeds the court's jurisdiction and creates a new unwritten judge-made rule. End of quote. That's kind of funny hearing that come from Liberals. They love judges kind of dictating what goes on in the country, but now they don't like it.
So, I would say that's a little unfair, though, John, because politicians like the judges to make the tough decisions that they don't want to make.
That's true.
That cuts across all parties.
That's true. No, the dislike is not as intense as what some people make it out to be, because there's a lot of politicians are very happy to have the courts deciding on everything from abortion to Aboriginal policy to immigration to whatever and just not be responsible for it.
It's out of our hands.
Yeah. So an Ottawa human rights lawyer named Yavar Hamid started a court action seeking a court declaration ordering the government to get its act together and make these judicial appointments. And the court's declaration is very interesting because it's kind of an order, but it's quite soft-spoken. So the result of this court action, the court declared, this is back in February when it released a ruling, quote, all federal judicial appointments are made by the Governor General on the advice of Cabinet, which in turn acts on the advice of the Minister of Justice. Appointments to fill judicial vacancies under Section 96 of the Constitution Act 1867 and Section 5.2 of the Federal Courts Act must be made within a reasonable time of the vacancy. Appointments to fill current judicial vacancies are required for the reasons set out in the letter from the Chief Justice of Canada and Canadian Judicial Council to the Prime Minister, dated May 3rd, 2023. The court makes declarations 2 and 3 above in its expectation that the number of said judicial vacancies will be materially reduced in a reasonable time, such that the total number of judicial vacancies returns to the mid-40s. So that is to say that there's only 40-something vacancies, not 80 or 90 or not a really high number. Continuing with the court ruling, in this manner, the court expects the untenable and appalling crisis and critical judicial vacancy situation found by this court, as identified by the Chief Justice and Canadian Judicial Council, will be resolved. End of the court ruling. So the court says, just to recap, that its declaration is that appointments to fill judicial vacancies are made by the Governor General on the advice of Cabinet, and they're required for the reasons for the crisis described by Chief Justice Wagner in his letter of May 3rd, 2023. And so the court has an expectation that the number of said judicial vacancies will be materially reduced. So materially meaning in a meaningful, relevant manner. So that's their order. It's pretty soft spoken. I mean, I've seen other court orders where it's, you know, the court orders that the plaintiff, you know, pay costs to the defendant or that the defendant refrain from doing this. And here it's a very, it's almost borderline not an order. It's almost like an expression of a wish. But I guess at the end of the day, when the court says that it has an expectation that the number of vacancies is going to go down to the mid-40s, the court's saying we've got that expectation. So I guess it was enough of an order to offend the federal government into appealing the decision.
Right. And I think I've told you this before, back when I was a construction site superintendent, it was taught to me that the hardest question to ask is when. And that's what I was waiting for in that order there was when. Is it 90 days? Is it going to be 30 days? How soon after a vacancy becomes open should it be filled? And maybe that's what they need to do, is pass a law that says when. How long can they leave it open? And that would, I guess, force the government's hand. If they, you know, if it was 90 days, I mean, be reasonable, right? Give them time if they need time, but not just leave it open and say within a reasonable amount of time. Reasonable is such a fudgy number, right? So maybe it just, you know, the whole question of when needs to be answered. It is a tough one, but, you know, maybe that's what we need here.
So Justice Wagner, you know, publicly denounced the truckers, which you would think made Trudeau happy. And now Trudeau returns the favor and expresses his gratitude by saying that, quote, quoting from the National Post article, the letter by Wagner is full of hearsay facts and opinion and should not be relied upon. End of quote. So yeah. Federal government are, you know, not publicly dissing this, I thought, very thoughtful, very well-written letter that had valid points on it, valid points that we've been making on this podcast the last 4 years, that we need to fill these vacancies. And by the way, the problem may have become greater under Trudeau, but this was already a huge problem under Stephen Harper, that there's a large number of vacancies that was always persisting, which hurts access to justice. And sadly, this is one of the few core tasks that is absolutely essential that government must do. There are a thousand things that government does that could be done as well and often better by voluntary actors and businesses and charities and neighbors and communities. And, you know, there's lots of things government does that it doesn't have to do that could be done by non-government actors. Okay. Running a court system and appointing judges is one of the few things that it's a core function of government that non-government actors cannot take care of.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you to speculate on why this is? Why is this a chronic problem? You've said it crosses, obviously, you know, party lines here, or different parties in power have the same problem. What on earth is causing this problem?
It's a great question. I just can't speculate as to what's going on in the minds and hearts of Justice Minister Varani and Prime Minister Trudeau. Rather, I think maybe they're relying on the opinions of the federal Justice Department lawyers who are saying, you know, this ruling is wrong in law and creates a dangerous precedent where, you know, you've got courts ordering governments to appoint more judges. I thought it was pretty mild. Like they're not, you know, it would be a huge problem if they said you have to appoint more progressive judges, or you have to appoint more female judges, or your judicial appointments need to, you know, kind of the garbage that the Supreme Court is tweeting, you know, we need more equity, diversity, inclusion. If there is a court ruling ordering the government to appoint a certain kind of judge, like that's bad. That's dangerous. That should be appealed. Here you've got the court saying, look, we've got what's turning into a crisis and you've got to fix this and you've got to do something about it. But they're not telling the government what kind of judges to appoint or who to appoint. So I don't really see what the fuss is about, but yeah, beyond that, I think they should put their time, effort, and energy into filling these vacancies rather than appealing the decision. Although you could do both.
Yeah, but it's not really a decision, you said. Is it really that much of a decision to appeal? It's pretty much just sort of plea, isn't it?
I guess they view it as a court order. That seems to be their rhetoric when you hear them talking about it. Mm-hmm. They're interpreting it as the court telling them what to do. And that is, in my view, it is a reasonable interpretation. You could say it's an order. But if it is an order, it's one of the most soft-spoken, indirect orders I've ever seen. And when you say, I have an expectation, I guess, if you were to, by way of comparison, let's say there's a workplace comparison, if the boss says, I expect to see that report on my desk on Monday morning, when you're talking about expectations, I guess it is an order.
Yeah, but it's an order for them to do their job, essentially, because they're the only ones that can do it, right? And it's coming from people that are, under the gun because they're not doing their job or they're not doing what is expected of them. They are basically neglecting this, and I don't see what's wrong with calling them out on it. If you're not telling them they have to do it by this date, then I can't really see it as a sort of a hard order.
No, and there isn't. I did not see a date in there that you've got to get the number of vacancies down to the mid 40s, by such and such a date. So we don't even know if the government's complying with the order or not, because if they get it down to the mid 50s, they could say, "Well, we are complying because we're working on it and we've made good progress." So it's pretty vague. So back to the last point on the Supreme Court, this one, unfortunately, back into the negative territory. The Supreme Court declined to hear the appeal of the Gateway decision. This was the Manitoba Court of King's Bench, Queen's Bench at the time when it was heard, but now the Court of King's Bench. This pertained to Manitoba public health orders issued in November of 2020 that there were no gatherings of any size or any kind at private residences. So you couldn't even have a friend, a neighbor, mother, father, son, daughter. Nobody could come, not even outdoors. So you couldn't even have somebody who's not a member of your own household come into your backyard. And of course, in December in Manitoba, you don't really want to be outside. I digress. No gatherings at private residence other than people that live there, that members of your own household. No more than 5 people could gather outdoors. Okay, so this, again, Neanderthal anti-science, as if 20 people outdoors, 6 feet apart from each other, are going to spread COVID. I mean, get real. But still, public outdoor gatherings limited to no more than 5 people. And churches were closed completely for 3 months. This at the same time when the government allows, of course, all the big box stores are open. That goes without saying. That's hundreds of people indoors. University classes, that's fine. Movie sets. The Winnipeg Jets, the hockey team, they can train along with their assistants and coaches and assistant managers and medical people, et cetera. They can all be indoors training. People training for the Summer Olympics. And of course, cannabis and liquor stores are open as well. So you got a lot of open stuff, but churches, oh my goodness, churches are a menace. They spread COVID and kill people. So we had to close churches entirely. So it's blatant anti-religious bigotry, like what we've seen on the part of Bonnie Henry in British Columbia as well. There's zero evidence that churches are big transmitters of COVID or worse transmitters than other venues. And yet, churches are going to get closed.
It's all that singing, don't you know? I think they had one study that said that's what it was. Out of the United States, there was one study.
Well, and this gets back to, the big lies. As on March the 15th, we passed the fourth anniversary of the assault on our rights and freedoms that began in most provinces on March the 15th, 2020, with the closing of schools and then other lockdown measures. Why? We were put into a state of fear by Dr. Neil Ferguson of Imperial College London, who said that COVID would kill 40 million people around the world in 2020. So in order to avoid the deaths of 40 million people, claiming falsely that this virus would be like the Spanish flu of 1918, we all had to lock down and people were scared and they obeyed. So it's almost, I don't know, it's kind of sad. You get the Supreme Court announcing just a day or two before the fourth anniversary of lockdowns, the Supreme Court announces they're not going to hear this appeal. But talking about singing in church, this is how stupid the rules were, the rules in Manitoba. So there's no restrictions on a business that is producing a motion picture or television show if filming had started before these orders came into effect. The film or television production set could involve hundreds of people in enclosed spaces with people unmasked and projecting their voices, shouting, singing, engaging in hand-to-hand combat, being intimate with each other, and so on. That's all allowed by Manitoba. And so the Supreme Court application, which I went through earlier today prior to recording the podcast, it says it was permissible to film a fictional church service, but not to hold a real one in Manitoba. So in fact, a film production company could have legally had, you know, where there's a movie that requires a church scene, they could have had 100, 200 people in a church and 50 people in a choir and everybody singing. And that would have been okay as part of a film production, but not a real church service. That was illegal in Manitoba.
Couldn't they just claim they were making movies? Hey.
Well, just... yeah, but then, you know, a lot of church people have got these qualms about lying. And oh, so, that. Yeah, yes. Oh, that. So the church folks, and do not misunderstand. I'm not suggesting that there's different levels of honesty, this and that. Okay. But, there's an awful lot of people that are church going that would not blatantly lie through their teeth to the government and say, oh yeah, you know, we're just doing a film production here.
Well, they could have just filmed the thing. And is that a film production? Oh, I don't know. I'm just being facetious, but still, yeah. And I mean, to be fair, Manitoba wasn't the only place with stupid rules. The important thing was that we did manage to get these into court first in Manitoba. And I think that was important. We had some very important things come out in that trial quite early. And one of the things that I realized sort of after the fact was that there was lots of evidence, contrary to Neil Ferguson's evidence, that lockdowns were not doing any good. And it was back then. So, you know, I mean, we often see in court, and we did in the Manitoba case, that, you know, they were saying, well, you know, we didn't know how bad this thing was and we didn't know how things were going to turn out. And it was all this great uncertainty. Well, there were lots of people stating at the time that these lockdowns are bad, that these lockdowns are hurting. And we have them scientific evidence as well being brought out to that effect at that time.
Well, it's quite early on in lockdowns that the data was available that lockdowns were killing more people in British Columbia through drug overdoses than the number of COVID deaths in BC. Bearing in mind, too, the COVID deaths are inflated because anybody who dies with COVID is deemed to have died of COVID. That was the practice. So the excess drug overdose deaths, so not the normal level, but the increase in drug overdoses, that number of people dying was higher than the number of people dying from COVID. So we knew that the cure was worse than the disease, and yet the courts did not take a hard look at the evidence. And that was one of the – so there's two big grounds of appeal that the lawyers provided by the Justice Center put to the court. One of them was just this discrepancy between constitutionally protected activities, which would include things like church service, freedom of religion and conscience, versus economic interests that are not protected by the charter. It's not hard to find a court ruling that will spell this out. You know, anybody who's ever gone into court saying that, well, you know, this government measure that's put me out of business, that's costing me money, that's wiped out my life savings, that's preventing me from earning a living, preventing me from supporting my family, this violates my charter right. They very quickly get shut down and said, no, the charter does not protect any economic interests. Okay. I don't think that's good, but that's the reality. That's the state of the law. So here in Manitoba and elsewhere, you've got the governments are deferring to economic interests and being very, you know, careful, which are not protected by the charter. Yet when it's a charter protected right, like freedom of religion and conscience, they're trampling all over that. So we asked the court to look at that discrepancy. The other big argument is the abuse of the precautionary principle. Now, in cases, many courts have said, look, we didn't know about the virus, so governments were justified in using a precautionary principle, and we don't really need to take a hard look at the evidence, right? As we've talked about, you know, people like Justice Renee Pomerantz in the Trinity Bible Chapel case in Ontario saying, quote, I am neither equipped nor inclined to resolve scientific controversies regarding COVID, end of quote, and totally abdicating their responsibility as judges by saying that the government just needs to come up with a little bit of evidence and then that's good enough. We're going to rule in favor of the government. And so the precautionary principle can be good if it itself does not inflict damage. I'll give you an example. Let's say I'm taking my dog to the vet. My dog is a very skittish, fear-filled, cowardly beast and feels horribly insecure and hates going to the vet. And you could put a muzzle over the dog as a precautionary measure to make sure that my dog, who typically doesn't bite anybody, has never bitten anybody, doesn't bite people, but you say, okay, we're going to do a precautionary measure and we're going to put a muzzle over her snout so that she cannot bite. The veterinarian is going to examine her. So far, so good. Okay, I'm in favor of, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. That's all wonderful. Precautionary principle is a good thing. Let's imagine a slightly different scenario. I'm taking the dog in to the vet. There is a small chance the dog might bite the vet. So as a precautionary measure, the vet says, we're going to inject the dog with a sedative. It's going to make the dog very, very tranquil and so not inclined to bite. This sedative might render the dog permanently blind or damage vision permanently. Permanent vision loss or damage to vision is the side effect of this sedative. Shall we go ahead and inject the dog with a sedative because we're all in favor of the precautionary principle? And then I would say no. If it's a muzzle that's going to inconvenience the dog, the dog's going to dislike it for the 5, 10, 15 minutes the dog's in there, okay, fine, go ahead with the muzzle. Why? Because it doesn't inflict damage. If you want to use a sedative that might render my dog blind as a precautionary measure, I'm going to say no, it's damaging. So in the same way with the lockdowns, the precautionary principle is valid. However, when the precautionary measure, namely lockdowns, is inflicting massive damage on people and is driving people to suicide, is causing drug overdoses, is harming children's mental health, emotional health, physical health by taking away their opportunity for sports, et cetera, when lockdowns are causing harm, you cannot blithely give a thumbs up to lockdowns just because they happen to be a precautionary measure. So a precautionary measure, even though it's a good thing in principle, and I support it in principle, you do have to take a hard look at whether that precautionary measure is inflicting damage. And if it does inflict damage, you cannot blithely rubber stamp your approval on it just because it's precautionary.
I just want to mention a couple of things that did come out in that Manitoba trial that have since gone on to other things. This was the admission by a microbiologist brought in by the government who said that the PCR tests were, you know, basically 50% useless, or 50% of the people that tested positive
were not sick.
We're not sick at all. Yeah. And that actually
did not have COVID. Yeah. So the government of Manitoba was lying to the people every day. But every time they said, we've got 1,000 cases of COVID, they knew that 560 of those 1,000 people did not have COVID. And if that was happening in Manitoba, why would you think it was not happening in other provinces? And of course, the whole thing was an abuse of the English language in any event, because pre-2020, the word case referred to somebody who was sick. How many cases of breast cancer are there in your province every year? Well, there's whatever, 1,259 cases. Well, those are people who have breast cancer. So a case means you got the disease. And the media were fear-mongering with, oh, we've got 1,000 COVID cases. Well, that wasn't 1,000 people who were sick with COVID. It was 1,000 people that had tested positive on a PCR test. So,
which has been proven useless at this point. The other point that came out in that trial, it was notable because of the testimony of Jay Bhattacharya, the Stanford professor that we had as one of our expert witnesses. He had come in, and what was significant about him was he was a co-author of the Great Barrington Declaration, which advocated for focused protection of the elderly instead of lockdowns. And so he provided expert testimony. And what's interesting about him now is that he's gone on to become a litigant in the Missouri versus Biden case, which is the free speech case down in the United States that some have called the most important free speech case of our generation. This is against the government for censoring people on Twitter, like Jay Bhattacharya. He is one of the applicants for censoring medical information. And this is very important. It's actually going before the court this week. So that was notable about the case as well. And I think we did mention that in our press release when we basically informed our supporters that we weren't going to be heard by the Supreme Court. But at least we got that note in. So people
absolutely.
Can see what's going
on. Speaking of our supporters, want to say again, thank you very much to all of you that are donating to support our work to defend the free society. The Justice Center is a registered charity, and we get 100% of our revenues come from voluntary donations. We have thousands of Canadians that are giving us different amounts, and all the money comes together. And we've got a team of 9 full-time lawyers from BC to Quebec, and paralegals, communication staff. And so if you donated in 2023, thank you very much. You would have gotten your official tax receipt in early February. And now as we're continuing our work, in particular, fighting the Online Harms Act, which now we are close to 50,000 signatures on against the on our online petition. So please visit www.jccf.ca, sign the petition, and consider making a donation as well. And I'm very grateful for the good people, the freedom-loving people that make it possible for the Justice Center to be your voice in the courts of law and the court of public opinion, advocating for the rights and freedoms of all Canadians. Thank you very much, and please continue with your support.
Yes, and thank you, John, for participating in our episode this week. I think it's an important one because we are talking about the highest court in the land. So thanks a lot, and I hope to speak to you again real soon.
Have a good week.